Today, if you think you're suddenly getting more emails from Miriam in Nigeria offering you a fantastic investment opportunity, it's not just your imagination. 3 years after the federal CAN Spam Act became law, the volume of unsolicited emails, or spam, has increased, doubled in the past year, according to one report, as spamming technology has become more sophisticated. Today, we're going to talk about why it is so hard to block the spammers. If you're a computer user, what have you done to stop unwanted emails? Has it worked? The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us an email, no investment solicitations, please, talk@npr.org is our address. Joining us now is Declan McCullough, senior writer for CNET, who joins us from the studio at cnetnews.com in San Francisco. Declan, nice to have you on the program again.
Hi there. Why, thank you.
It was just 3 years ago, I believe, that no one less than Bill Gates said, by the end of 2006, we're going to have this spam problem licked.
It's true. But if you look at Bill Gates' other predictions back in the 1980s, he said, what was it, 640 kilobytes was enough for anyone. I'm not sure if he's a great technology forecaster.
Nevertheless, what happened? It is as recently as 9 months ago, it looked like any number of things were beginning to work to whittle down the volume of spam.
It's true. I mean, the way the spam fight has gone over the last 10 years or so that I've been writing about it is that you come up with some good anti-spam defenses, and then the offense comes up with some new schemes that foil them. And so it's a constant arms race. And right now, the spammers are winning.
And so this leapfrog technology, as anti-spammers find some device that filters it out, the spammers figure out another way to do it.
Exactly. A few years ago, maybe two, 3 years ago, the idea was, let's look at key phrases in messages and say, well, Viagra, mortgage solicitations, phrases like that are not that likely to appear in most people's email. And so you can do some statistical computations and figure out, hey, these if it matches this pattern, mm-hmm. Roughly, then let's filter it. But now spammers are using things like image files they're sending. They instead of sending it in text, they'll send it in a GIF or JPEG. They'll also do things like send text taken from encyclopedias, from even works of fiction to try to bust these spam filtering techniques.
It also matters where this spamming originates from.
It does. In fact, what's been happening, especially in the last year or two, is that system administrators, network administrators who are responsible for keeping their customers, their employees' inboxes, and are not entirely overflowing, keeping them sane, is they'll start blocking out entire blocks of internet addresses, sometimes even entire countries, saying there's so much spam that's coming from, South Korea. It's just, and we get so few legitimate email messages that let's just block that entire nation. This is a distressing trend, really, but there's not much that can be done.
And I gather a lot of the countries that are involved now are in Eastern Europe and in Russia.
Also true. Russia, especially, is a big source of spam.
Now, botnets. Botnets are apparently a big part of this, too. What are they and how do they work?
Well, this is geek speak for the concept that computers on the internet are relatively insecure, especially if they're running Windows. You stand a better chance of having a secure computer if you're running Linux or Apple's OS X operating system. And so because Windows, at least historically, has had a lot of security issues, it's easy, and because it's more prevalent, it's easier for a malicious person to exploit. So what they do, a bot will take over your computer and essentially infect it, and then use it as a source of spam. And because your computer, up until the moment it got infected, was a perfectly legitimate computer, it had a very good reputation, so to speak, it was not known as a source of spam, and then it goes over to the dark side at that moment. it's very difficult for the anti-spam guys to detect.
Now, but doesn't this have to have a return address? I mean, if they're trying to get us to do something, don't we have an address to respond to figure out who is responsible for sending out this spam, no matter where in the world they may happen to be?
Yes and no. I mean, they're sort of different types of spam. I mean, it didn't always used to be this way. 5 years ago, it was, hey, just buy my Viagra and click on this link. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it's you do have that sort of almost legitimate spam, which is click here and go to my website. But nowadays, you also have phishing spam, which is P-H-I-S-H, that is how it's spelled, which is spam that's designed to essentially be fraudulent. It pretends it's coming from Bank of America or your credit card company and says your account is having problems. Click here to reset your security code, and it'll ask you for all this information. And then your credit card or bank account is compromised. So that's fraudulent spam, and they don't need a working website. At least legitimate website for that. Another type would be just pumping up small stocks, especially small cap stocks. They could just say, hey, this small cap stock is going to go up. Time to buy it now. And they don't need a working website to pull that one off.
Because they could just buy the stock and then buy it low. And then after it's pumped up, sell it. And they've made a profit. But does that actually work? I mean, when you get a blind email saying Verschlagener Enterprises is going to go through the roof, does anybody actually buy Verschlagener?
Well, they wouldn't keep doing it unless it works, and it's just a question of numbers. It's very, very cheap for spammers to send out bulk email. They can do it for a very, very small fraction of a cent, and so you just need a few people, idiots basically, or people who don't know any better, to click on that link, buy that product, buy that Rolex, or say maybe I should look into the stock to make it worthwhile. Even if they get a fraction of 1% response rate, it still is profitable.
Hmm. Here's an email question we have from Melanie, who's also in San Francisco. Much of the spam I've been receiving uses a sender name that matches the names of people I regularly send email to. How does this happen? Does this mean that somebody has access to my email database?
It could be sort of the opposite, that someone has access to her friends' or correspondence email databases. Again, if you're using Microsoft Outlook, I don't mean to pick on Microsoft, but Microsoft has had security problems and a lot of people use it, then it can insinuate itself, and the worm or virus can crawl into Outlook and then sort of start sending off spam messages to people in that person's address book. So it's probably not her computer that's infected. In fact, it's probably someone else's, one of her correspondents.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get a caller on the line. This is John. John's with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi there. Well, I just wanted to mention that in my fight against spam, basically, last year, I hit the point where it was driving me up the wall, and I was seeing probably about 50% of my incoming mail as all spam. And I built my own website and collected instructions from all over the web and built a guide for new users to build their own anti-spam gateway. I call it the Pirate Fish. Now it's seeing I'm only getting about 25% of my incoming mail as spam, but that's all being blocked. And now in the last 2 months, I've been seeing probably 6 to 10 messages a night leaking through. Hmm. And I've even gone as far as performing optical character recognition on incoming mail to detect, you know, Viagra and Cialis and things hiding inside the messages. Beyond that, the one thing I think people should know is that SPF records need to be created to help stave off phishing attacks against financials, and that's something I just want to throw in for you guys to know about.
Okay. Declan McCullough, first of all, does John's approach sound reasonable, and what's an SPF?
An SPF is...
Let's get it from Declan, all right?
Yeah, it's... Okay.
Oh, John can explain it. He sounds more hardcore than I am, but his approach is reasonable. SPF is a way. A little bit of background first. One of the problems with the way the internet's email system works today is that it was created in the mid-1980s when computers on the internet trusted each other. People were more honest maybe back then, or the spammers hadn't figured things out. And so you could forge from lines. And so I could, in other words, pretend to be sending mail from npr.org, and it would probably go through. And so SPF and similar techniques are ways to try to make computers a bit more honest and repair some of the problems that arose out of the more freewheeling days of the 1980s. And so it involves putting information into your computer's domain name records that says these are the only hosts that can send mail from NPR.org. It's probably a little bit too much information, but it's one of the countermeasures that has been that have been developed in the last 2 years.
And does it work?
It would work better if more people did it, but it's just there's no silver bullet for spam. SPF is not one of them, or can't be one of them. It's a function of law enforcement. We need police, law enforcement to take this more seriously, especially the spammers who are breaking into systems, running botnets, committing fraud, and we need better technology as well. And we need users to be smarter, not click on these links.
And John, does SPF stand for something as simple and understandable as spam protection factor?
We wish. Open policy sender policy framework.
Sender policy framework. John,
yeah, it it's a simple DNS record that somebody can put onto their domain that says, if you get a mail and it doesn't come from this IP address or these IP addresses or this network, don't let it come in.
John, thanks very much, and good luck with your website.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about the explosion yet again of spam. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go to John. And John's with us from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
How you doing?
Okay.
Just wanted to comment on your topic right now. And I run several servers for clients down here. And one of the servers that I maintain for them is different email servers and things of that nature. And, again, like everybody else has been saying, the sheer level of volume is unimaginable. My particular email address myself, I usually get in excess of 1,000-plus emails a day, and usually only two or three of them are actually worthwhile. Making comparison to snail, I don't think there's any way that you're really going to be able to prevent it with the current software and technology the way it is now, because all somebody really needs to do is just change the name and address on the return address, and then it's from somebody completely different from somewhere totally different altogether, and you can't block the entire world. I've been coming up with an idea that maybe if they could change the way software function, change the protocol a little bit so that maybe have it be like you have your email address contact list on your remote server where you retrieve your email from, and like instant messaging, block everybody that you don't know. And if somebody wants to send you an email, you got to get their email address and put it into that list. Other than that, there's no way you're ever going to be able to block everything.
It sounds like John has a potential solution, Declan McCullough, but one that a lot of people aren't going to be happy about. They like getting emails from people they may not necessarily know or know all that well.
It's true. I mean, right now we've been trying mostly a blacklist approach in terms of spam fighting. These are computers that have been compromised, that are the source of spam. Let's block them out and take incoming email from the rest of the world. What we're moving towards, and this does have sociological repercussions, is a whitelist approach. Only if you call me on the telephone, give me your email address, and I type it into my sort of email guard dog, is it going to be let through? And this wasn't the way email was intended, but this is at least one way to stop spam. Hmm.
John, good luck. Thanks very much.
Oh, actually, one last comment, if I can. Something I've been suggesting to my users is to have at least two personal email addresses for yourself, because a lot of these email addresses, the spammers are getting them through websites and things like that. So if you use your email address to register on a website, chances are it's going to get out there. Mm. So if you have one email address that you use for registering addresses and things like that, and then have one that you only use for personal contacts, and tell your contacts not to give out your email address, it really helps cut down spam a lot on the one that you really want to look at.
Your contacts are more closed mouths than mine, John. But anyway, good luck. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Let's get another caller in. This is Stu. Stu's with us from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is a question that's been bothering me for a long time. I've opened very few spam mails that I've received, and I've received quite a few of them, and they all seem to be advertising something. And I have yet to meet anyone who has purchased anything as a result of receiving a spam advertisement. So if no one is buying what they're selling, why do they continue to use this as a method for advertising?
Let me ask that to Declan McCullough, and you sort of answered it before. You only need a few idiots to respond to make it profitable, right?
Exactly. Because of the massive volumes involved, you send out a million spam messages, and even if your response rate is 1/10, 1/100 of 1%, it's still going to be worthwhile.
And if you're using a netbot, your costs for doing this are virtually nil.
Exactly. I mean, this is running a collection of bots is fraudulent. It violates federal computer hacking laws. But you know, spammers aren't always paying close attention to the laws, and so it can be worth it. I mean, we've all read the stories about how the spammers have the Ferrari, six bedroom house with the bars of gold buried in the backyard. In one case involving AOL, it was pretty funny.
Stu, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And before we let you go, Declan McCullough, is anybody working on the next leapfrog from the spam blockers side?
Well, one way that's promising is to make it more expensive for spammers to do their thing. In the physical world, nobody really likes junk email, but we don't get that much of it because it costs the sender something to send it to us. In other words, they have to stick a postage stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can do the same thing in the spam world, say, I'm only going to let email come in if you put a 5-cent postage note on it. Maybe this can be done with digital money. Maybe this can be done with PayPal. Then that's at least one promising technique. Or something called hash cash is a very preliminary look at this, and that's make the sender perform a math computation that's going to take him, say, 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem for a legitimate sender, but it is a problem for spammers when they're sending out millions of messages. So there are some techniques on the horizon that might help us in this ongoing fight against spam.
But then I'd have to look at all those messages I get about my PayPal account, which I don't have. Anyway, Declan McCullough, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Declan McCullough, senior writer for CNET News. He joined us from their studios in San Francisco, California. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.